from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum, astronomer Dimitar Sazalov, director of Harvard's Origins of Life Initiative, will join us to discuss his new book, The Life of Super-Earths, and explain why he thinks planets larger than Earth offer the best prospects for finding life as we know it, or as we don't know it. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. There are as many as 7,000 exoplanets outside of our solar system and counting. There are planets that really could sustain life, and planet hunter Dimitar Sazalov is all about finding out. In his recently published book, The Life of Super-Earths, How the Hunt for Alien Worlds and Artificial Cells Will Revolutionize Life on Our Planet, Harvard astronomer Sazalov looks at planets that on their surface appear compatible, if not potentially superior, to sustaining life as we know it, or perhaps as we don't. And one of the leaders of NASA's Kepler mission, Dimitar Sazalov, is founder and director of Harvard's Origin of Life Initiative. He's a TED and Davos speaker, and he joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. Good to have you here. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's talk about all. You've been a planet hunter now for a while. Let's talk about why and how they might be sustaining life as we know it or as we don't. I mean, a lot of the promise is in the idea of super-Earths because they're bigger. They have more, tectonic plate. They have more atmosphere, potentially, volcanic activity. All of those things are rocky. And so they seem to be, at least on the surface, but how do we find out? I mean, we can't even reach there, and let alone astronomers even get there in any way, right?
Absolutely. We've learned how to do things remotely for the past century, both discovery, and we are here in the home of planet hunting, the Bay Area, with both the Kepler mission as well as the big team at Berkeley and Santa Cruz.
And the SETI program?
Yeah. Yes, yes. So basically, we know how to find the planets remotely now. We, as you mentioned, we have thousands of candidates by now. We also know how to measure their properties, although in bulk. And then the next step is to measure their atmospheres. That's what we call remote sensing, finding out what kind of gases are in those atmospheres. The next step of that is biosignatures, the gases which could reveal the existence of a biosphere. And that's where we need to do a lot of homework.
We're also talking, though, in your book about doing a lot of the homework here. I mean, that was really what I wanted to emphasize. We can't get there. It's too far away, really. So there are ways of kind of going into, the chemistry labs and creating a kind of synthetic biology that can tell us about molecular structure potentially or microbic structures. Yeah,
absolutely. That's what compelled me to write this book, is that unlikely marriage between biology and astronomy, which goes both ways. The astronomers are now capable of doing those measurements, and we ask ourselves, isn't it foolish to assume that life is literally a carbon copy of life on Earth when we look out there to other planets? That implies even a search for life on Mars, but less so, but especially to exoplanets. And then there is the other direction in which efforts in the lab have so far failed to create what we would call the minimal cell, understanding the basic functions of the chemistry that underlies the complexity of life on Earth. And maybe the combination of two, especially what astronomers could bring to the table and to the lab, is those initial chemical conditions which could help us looking for alternatives.
Well, I also keep thinking, you know, I remember as a kid I used to always hear that phrase, life as we know it. Can there be life as we know it on Venus or on Mars? And there's also that sense of life forms, again, as we don't know or can't know. I mean, we found things in the ocean, for example, that we didn't know were life forms, right?
Precisely. I mean, life as we know it is an easy thing to say because, well, we know. We see it. We know what it is. We don't have a good definition of it. We don't understand its nature. But even here on Earth, life as we know it is so rich and surprises us all the time. We could say, well, the solar system is in some ways very similar to Earth. But when you go to exoplanets, the richness of what we discover is so much vaster. And then the question goes back to the lab. What exactly is life as we know it? And do we understand its nature?
There could be, from what you tell us, about 100 million planets with habitable life of some form out there. And maybe even beyond that.
Yeah, we would be a little bit more modest in saying that it's planets potentially habitable as opposed to with life.
Well,
there.
We also could be all
but
alone,
we
right?
We don't know. We could be, yes. The important thing is, in what you said, is that large number of hundreds of millions of potentially habitable planets in our galaxy alone simply tells us that the question about life on other planets is now shifting from being purely astronomical, are there places which could support life out there, to a biological, what does it take for life to emerge given the environments? And that's a historical shift from astronomy to biology, which is happening right now.
And how does it lead us, though, to anything other than hypothesis? I mean, we can, for example, create this marriage between biology and astronomy and say this planet that's out there could sustain life as we know it or could sustain another form of life, but that conclusion does what for us or leads us where?
The question is very good. That is, what of that is conceptual and what of that is experimental? What is the practical mm-hmm. consequence of this? Indeed, there are milestones which are experimental. And what you see in the exoplanet field now is historical milestones which are experimental in nature. Kepler essentially is at the cusp of making a historical measurement of Earth-sized planets in the habitable zone of other stars. Conceptually, this was an idea which is with a 500-year heritage, going back to Copernicus and the astronomers of the time, in fact, Johannes Kepler himself. However, what is important about this shift and that discovery that is coming from the exoplanet field is that brings about the opportunity for new conceptual breakthroughs. And that new field of synthetic biology, combined with what we learn from astronomy, is where these new breakthroughs can occur. And they will be conceptual, not just experimental.
We're talking, if you just joined us, with Dimitar Sazalov, who is an astronomy professor at Harvard and directs the Harvard Origins of Life Initiative, author of The Life of Super Earths, How the Hunt for Alien Worlds and Artificial Cells Will Revolutionize Life on Our Planet. How's it going to revolutionize life on our planet?
What is happening in the field of life sciences, and some of it is ironically motivated by the developments in astronomy and exoplanet research, is that bottom-up approach of building functionalities with molecules from scratch, functionalities which resemble the functionalities of life, all the way up to a minimal cell, artificial minimal cell. When this project is successful, even partially successful, it implies the ability to design materials and functions which are unheard of, which resemble the synthetic tools of organic chemistry of the past century, which brought us the plastics and the new materials which we use widely today. So in that sense, the spin-offs from the development of chemical synthetic biology are something which would affect our lives in the near future in very practical terms.
And Kepler is finding more and more of these exoplanets each month. That's a fact, isn't it?
The Kepler mission revolutionized the field of exoplanets, literally, and is still doing so. We are on the cusp of determining what is one of the most important parameters for the last 400 years. How often do planets like the Earth really occur in our galaxy? This is going to happen in the next a few years, and Kepler is leading the way in that sense.
You had a role in the Kepler mission, so you saw a lot of the excitement that was attached to finding all these Earth-like planets and stars like the Sun.
That is the goal of the Kepler mission, discovering Earth-sized planets in the habitable zones of planets like the Sun. Kepler's home is here, and I'm very happy to be in the Bay Area. The pioneer who really thought of the concept and saw it through is Bill Borucki, and it is just an honor to be part of such exciting team.
What's so special about Kepler, though? I mean, what new technology allows for the discoveries with Kepler?
The new technologies are, I would break it down to two major parts. One of them is the ability to build a really large digital camera. And here we're talking mostly about the detector rather than the lens. It is a very large camera, very large detector. And the second part is our ability to analyze large amounts of data with the help of computer technology, which has exponentially grown in the last 10 years. So that combination allows you to sort and sift through huge amounts of data and find very weak signals and hence discover those tiny transits which are due to Earth-sized planets around other stars.
How far away are we talking about?
Typically, the stars that we monitor with the Kepler telescope are between 500 to 3,000 light years away from us. It is a particular field and part of the galaxy that we explore.
And can you aim it very precisely?
The Kepler telescope is aimed very precisely. Over the past 50 years, we've learned how to point space telescopes very precisely in a particular direction on the sky. But what is more important is that it is aiming precisely and it is observing without any interruptions all those hundreds of thousands of stars over year after year. And we get perfect data down to Earth to detect those really tiny signals.
A question about how this marriage between astronomy and synthetic biology is actually going to advance our understanding of life. Because it is, isn't it? Inevitably?
Ironically, we talk a lot about life and even searching for life on other planets, Mars and beyond. But we don't have a definition of what life is. We certainly don't understand its basic nature. And one of the big questions of humanity has been about what is the nature of life. What I'm trying to do in this book, and has been a fascination of mine for the last few years, is to step back and look at the phenomenon of life from the perspective of being an astronomer, from the perspective of what we know and what we have learned about the galaxy, about the evolution of elements and stars in this galaxy, and then the planets, where we expect life to emerge. And certainly we know only one example of that, but that's where we expect it to emerge and essentially to look for it on other planets.
Now, what about beyond this galaxy? We now know that there are millions and millions of galaxies.
That's true. We know that there are as many galaxies as there are stars in our own galaxy. But frankly, I have to be practical about it. Let's just stick to our own neighborhood and our galaxy first. If we are successful, there's plenty of places in our neighborhood. It is very difficult to go beyond our galaxy. They're just too far away to do the kind of measurement we are talking about.
How about the funding for these projects, especially with NASA being cut back?
Well,
there's private funding now, isn't it?
There is private funding, especially for SETI, but the NASA Kepler mission, which is the main driver of the field right now, is fully funded.
That's been
by
fully
NASA.
Funded, yeah.
And we hope and expect that we'll get an extension to the mission. It's officially actually ending this year because it's doing very well and it will actually achieve fully its potential if it continues for another 4 years. It's already there. So it's a minor addition to the funding which took to build it and put it there. as far as funding for synthetic biology is involved, that comes from a number of sources. And the reason for that, and it's good, is that there is a lot of potential spin-offs and applications. So I would like to see it as being funded both from places which involved with medicine and therapies, as well as new materials, as well as essentially any kind of industry which is thinking about new ways to develop materials and functionalities which we cannot do with our current synthetic tools in chemistry.
Our guest is Harvard astronomy professor Dimitar Sazalov, and his new book is The Life of Super-Earths. Let's talk a little bit about what you talk write about a good deal, and that is the 2004 transit of Venus. Why is that so important?
The transit of Venus is important for two reasons. First of all, it's just a beautiful thing to see. So I would highly recommend
just
to
aesthetically,
you. Yes. The last one is happening on June 5th this year, and this is the last one this century. So they come in pairs. The previous one was in 2004, the next one is this year, and then the next one is next century, 22nd century we are talking about here. So it is a beautiful event because the planet Venus is relatively large. You don't need a telescope to see it on the face of the sun. It will be happening in the afternoon and sunset hours here in California. So it will be easy to see. Just find a cloudless spot to be able to see it. It's the last chance. So I would say go ahead and make plans for it. However, historically, the transit of Venus was very important for two reasons. Part of it was half philosophical, half convincing the remaining holdouts of the non-Copernican system at the time. But even with the first transits of Venus, people realized that this is a great way to triangulate the distance between the Earth and the Sun by using Venus as a kind of triangulation point in between. And so a lot of effort was put to observe those transits because that meant that you could measure more accurately your position on the surface of the Earth. And so navigation was a big beneficiary from knowing the distance between the Earth and the Sun. So this is probably the first time when major international scientific projects and competitive projects came to be when the first of those transits were observed in the 1700s.
Again, if you've just joined us, we're talking to Dimitar Sazalov, Harvard astronomy professor and director of the Harvard Origins of Life Initiative, author of The Life of Super-Earths, How the Hunt for Alien Worlds and Artificial Cells Will Revolutionize Life on Our Planet. He'll be appearing at the Commonwealth Club later on this evening at 6 o'clock here in San Francisco. And you can join us, by the way, if you have questions or comments. In fact, we invite you to be part of the program. You can do that now by calling our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, we welcome your involvement in the program. Again, toll-free number 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment and participate in that way. And, of course, you can also go to our Facebook page, and we do welcome your calls. Wondering, in something in your book that really caught my attention, that was this idea that life is indestructible on the Earth. It doesn't matter if we're hit by an asteroid or if we get in a nuclear war. Somehow, well, everybody always thinks the cockroaches are going to survive, but you're talking more about microbes, really, aren't you?
Microbes are kings. They rule our planet, and they have always ruled our planets. This was a realization that struck me when I first realized, thanks to my colleagues, the biologists who study life in the depth below the ocean floor and deep into the cracks of the Earth's crust. There are a lot of microbial communities that exist those depths. Many of them exist entirely surviving on heat that comes from the interior of the Earth, which is a huge reservoir, and do not depend on what is happening on the surface. So essentially, if you eliminated the surface, the oceans, the atmosphere, and obliterated, obviously, all life on the surface, a lot of those communities will continue living happily ever after because they depend only on the internal heat of the Earth and all the chemicals which are supplied by that large reservoir.
So we discovered those arsenic-based forms
maybe,
right here in California.
Yeah, they're in the lake indeed, so they will be part of the surface life that will be obliterated. But they're microbes which are a couple of miles deep below the surface. That's very far. And some of them have been isolated from the surface literally for millions of years. And what is even more amazing, not all of them are microbes. Just last year, there was a discovery of a small worm, a whole bunch of them living also very deep below. So we know very little about the biosphere, even on our own planet. But what we know of it, it's very resilient, it's very robust. And in a sense, probably already for billions of years, it's managed to reach places which insulate it from the cosmic vagaries of the sun or asteroid impacts or what happens to the surface.
What do you say to the, I don't know how much of a strident argument it is, but there are those who say we should be exploring the ocean depths more than perhaps looking out in space. This is our planet after all, and there's a lot down there that we don't know just as much as there's a lot out in space that we don't know.
What I would say, we should explore more of everything. After all, that's what a human spirit is all about, exploration, isn't it? So I would say yes, yes, and yes. It's a win-win,
exploring everything. With lack of revenue for yes, yeah, one of the
well,
yeses.
Well, we explore as much as we could. Some of it takes more money, some of it less. We'll never stop from exploration, as T.S. Eliot said.
Comment on our webpage says, can this study answer the fundamental question of how life essential RNA and DNA emerge from basic molecules?
Hopefully, eventually we'll know that. I think that's one of the big open questions. Is it those particular molecules or is it just one alternative which depends on the conditions, planetary conditions, different planetary system? We don't know the answer. And interestingly, it is a question that can be answered in the lab. We don't need to go to Mars to answer this question. I think this is the exciting opportunity opened by both the exoplanet research and what is happening in the life sciences. The ability to at least make one significant step towards answering this question.
That's what you're trying to do in the Origins of Life initiative, isn't it?
That's what we are trying to do, indeed. The basic question there is, do alternative biochemistries exist? Are they technically possible? And even if we find just one alternative, one example, as Jill Tarter, my colleague from the SETI Institute, likes to say, the difference between one and two makes all the difference. And so the same is true with life. The difference between one example and two, a second one, will make all the difference.
We still have to decide if we meet and have a close encounter of the third kind. How are we going to greet them? What are we going to say? What kind of language are we going to find to communicate? Well, all that sort of comes under the rubric of what we're talking about. But we're really talking about the exciting work that Professor Dimitar Sazalov is doing in his new book, which is again called Super-Earths, The Life of Super-Earths, How the Hunt for Alien Worlds and Artificial Cells Will Revolutionize Life on Our Planet. You can join us. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us forum at kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with astronomer Dimitar Sazalov, who directs Harvard's Origins of Life initiative, and discussing his new book, The Life of Super-Earths, and talking about why he thinks planets larger than Earth offer perhaps the best prospects of finding life as we know it, or maybe as we don't know it. And you are welcome to join this discussion, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. We welcome your questions and comments. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. And there are other ways to communicate with us. Email us, forum at kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or go to our Facebook page. And we were talking a little bit about communication when we were off the air. You were saying microbes, huh? That's the way we maybe could wind up communicating if there's extraterrestrial life.
Practically speaking, microbes are probably the first signs of life we'll discover out there. If there is any other life on other planets, it will be small size, single cell, those small number of cells of some sort, probably not plants and animals. It has to be a biosphere which transforms the planet, which transforms the surface and the atmosphere of the planet for us to be able to even have a fighting chance to detect it remotely from here.
What do you think? I want to get to our callers here, but what do you think in general about the work of SETI? I mean, there has been a good deal of controversy over the fact that nothing has been found, and yet the work has been quite valuable in many ways, hasn't it?
I am a big supporter of SETI for both of those reasons. One of them is that I'm a big believer that we should be listening. Frankly, it's not expensive at all to continue listening and to improve our listening abilities. And the second reason is what you mentioned. There are a lot of very valuable spin-offs from our ability to scan large swaths of frequency space across the sky and be able to do that technically.
Let me bring our callers in. Our first caller joining us from, well, it's like another planet, Selma, Alabama. Brandon, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, you guys. No, I'm actually in Selma, San Francisco, but I was in the PhD program, and I just wanted to say I know how difficult it is. Like, the money in our culture is really in finance and Wall Street. I just wanted to give Dr. D a props and thank you. I know I've spent a lot of time in cold, lonely labs tending tissue cultures, and our culture doesn't reward and doesn't properly pay what you do. I mean, what you do, like, is really the foundation of whether our country can become great in the future, and it really is, it was the bedrock of why we became great in the past. And going forward, I just hope we really learn to value science and rather than contest it and see that you guys are not out trying to get big bonuses like all those guys on Wall Street shuffling one pile of money to another who really create nothing. I mean, and while you are really advancing our technical knowledge, and I just want to thank you for that. And I hope everybody listening just starts to realize, like, what really generates wealth and prosperity in this country. It's not a bunch of people creating exotic financial instruments. It's people like this man. So thank you. I'll
All
take
right.
My
thank
comment
you.
Up here.
Giving you props for your work there and your science.
Thank you, Brandon. Exploration is all about innovation, and that what moves us forward and what has been great about this country, indeed. And just think of Bill Borucki, the pioneer of the Kepler mission. I mean, he started talking about this and working on it in 1984, took his whole career, and finally it's working and it's delivering this historic shift in our frame of reference.
And we go to another caller, and that's you, Roger. You're on.
Yes, thank you, Michael. You know, I've long believed that there's life in other parts of our galaxy, perhaps, of course, in the universe itself. But I think people don't understand what we're talking about in light years. First of all, the universe itself is approximately 14 billion years old. Our solar system, our planets, our solar system is only 4 billion, a little less than 4 billion. To give a concept of distance, if we were to find a little snail and put it on the road to Paris, that would be too fast to go a light year. The nearest star to us is approximately 4 light years away. My concern is, first of all, I applaud your work. I'm not trying to denigrate it in any way. But I think we're neglecting our own planet. You know, we have global warming on the horizon. We have unexplored areas in our own planet. They've just discovered a lake in Antarctica. I mean, there's a lot of work to be done right here on this little spaceship Earth. And although I applaud the research, of course, listening is important. It'd be wonderful if we could find some kind of communication with another system. But even if we did find it, our messages would take so long to reach it, everyone on this planet who sent it would be dead. So I applaud the research. Pure research is wonderful. But I believe we're neglecting our own planet. And that's my only point. And thank you, Michael, for giving me this opportunity.
All right, Roger, thank you for the call. And we've got a response from Professor Zaslow.
Roger, I'm really glad you called with this point. The reason I'm saying that is I spent about two chapters of my book talking exactly about what you're talking about. The huge disparity in spatial scales between the universe we now know and we live in, and what life is, and why is life at the scale it is. And one of the things which compelled me to write this book is because, as we have learned from 20th century physics, space and time are the four dimensions of the world we inhabit. And then just think about the fourth dimension, the time dimension. Life on Earth has existed for almost 4 billion years now. We know that from the geological record. And as you mentioned, the universe itself is about 14 billion years old. These are two numbers which are comparable to each other. So now you have to put life in the fourth dimension, and suddenly it becomes a very significant part of this world. In the four dimensions, although it's tiny, tiny in the three spatial dimensions. And to me, that gives us a new perspective on our little planet Earth and our little biosphere here on this planet Earth. And that perspective comes back to our daily lives here and really understanding what we should be doing on the Earth. And as you said, there's so much we need to explore and understand on our own planet. Absolutely. In fact, the search for alternatives to life should be done here on our planet, too. There is the issue of the possible existence of a shadow biosphere, which we haven't even made much progress looking for on our own planet.
And when you talk about the universe, of course, it brings to mind a number of programs we've done on string theory with people like Brian Greene. There may be not only multiverses, but alternate universes and parallel universes and potentially universes beyond the imagination, infinite.
Precisely. And again, I would like to say that we have to think about all dimensions. And if you think about life as a system, the way we see it here on our own planet, life is a system which has the potential for eternity. Once it has emerged, it can go on indefinitely. It is a very unusual system of organization of ordinary matter, which is very different from everything else that we see in our observable universe.
If we can get out to some of these exoplanets, I mean, this is certainly beyond our dreams, maybe even our hopes at this point, but or bring material back like we did from Mars and that sort of thing, there's always concern about contamination, microbial contamination. That's why our astronauts go through all this kind of cleansing that they go through. What about that?
Issue of contamination is important because we don't understand, indeed, all the issues that are involved. In fact, NASA has a very important Office of Planetary Protection. And the issue of contamination goes both ways. We don't want to contaminate a fragile environment on Mars, which we then would not be able to explore, and vice versa. We don't want to bring something back here which could be potentially dangerous. The more we understand about the basis of living systems and how they interact with each other, especially at the microbial level, though, we understand that contamination usually involves species and chemical level of the biochemistry involved, which is very close to what already our microbiomes and our own species are close to. So when it's difficult to contaminate with something which is completely alien. In other words, there is little compatibility. So in that sense, there is less concern now that we understand better the solar system and we understand better microbiology than, for example, was 50 years ago.
Have we learned much from microbes that have come to us and meteorites have kind of hitchhiked here, as it were?
Well, unfortunately, we haven't discovered microbes which hitchhike here. That will be one of the biggest discoveries, a new alien form of life. But what we have discovered are two things. On one hand, meteorites, pieces of primordial rock from the solar system, do contain the basic building blocks of the molecules of life, amino acids, even nucleobases. That's very interesting, and it's a fascinating work in progress. On the other hand, there are already a sufficient number of spacecraft where microbial spores have experienced space flight in near-Earth orbit or further out. And it is also very fascinating new research to see and understand how those microbes have managed to survive the open space environment and how they have changed, which is, again, something very new and exciting.
And again, feel free to join the program. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Here's a listener, Vincent, who writes, "Great show today. My wife and I were so inspired by the Kepler mission that we named our son Kepler. Can we dare to dream that humans might one day visit these Earth-like planets, or are we still limited to visiting them in our imagination and our science fiction?"
We ourselves probably will be lucky if we visit Mars, and I hope we could. I would love to. Those planets are very far away. Will we ever do that? I'm sure we will.
Well,
one of those days.
We could find a wormhole or something like that, right? Here's a listener, Jim, who says, "My speculation is that intelligence consciousness may evolve into a disembodied form, which would be another reason that embodied intelligence is a phenomenon of brief duration."
That brings a very interesting point, the point of the generation of life we are here on Earth, when, again, I step back and look at it from the perspective of astronomy. Very interesting, because we see a universe which is relatively young in the observable part of it, at least what we see. We see the age when galaxies started forming. We see the age when the first stars and later generations of stars form. We see that planets needed the first generations of stars to get going, because you need the heavy elements. And then you have planet Earth with the biosphere. And so there is a generation of life, at least maybe we're the only ones, but the first generation, which has this chemical origins, planetary origins, essentially chemistry emerging from the chemistry of the planet, which then develops into biochemistry. So we are part of that biochemistry, obviously. We are the result of the current evolution of this biosphere. If we think about future generations, they will have to be a generation too, which begins its roots, its tree of life, not from the planet itself, but from the existing branches of a tree that started that way. Mm-hmm. And this is where chemical synthetic biology may be hinting towards the future emergence of that generation too in our galaxy. In any case, we will be always the pioneering generation one.
Again, our guest, Dimitar Sasolov, and his book is called The Life of Super-Earths. Here's a listener, Peter from Oakland, who says, "The Kepler telescope measures very faint points of light from distant places. How can scientists determine whether or not a planet has water and thus possibly life from such little information?"
That's the beauty of the Kepler telescope. It looks at many 150,000 tiny points of light simultaneously every 30 minutes. There is a data point for each one of them. We see the slight dimming due to the transits of planets that happen to be oriented in their orbits so that they pass in between us and the star. When a few of those dimmings occur periodically, we know we have a candidate planet. And eventually, once we confirm it, we know its size because of the amount of dimming, but also we can measure in quite a few cases its mass. From knowing its diameter and its mass, we can determine the mean density of a planet. And what we discover is a rich diversity of mean densities for those planets. Some of them are indeed rocky. Kepler-10b was the first rocky planet we discovered with Kepler. Some of them a very low density, like small planets in the Kepler-11 system, which implies that they must have a lot of gas in their makeup. And some of them are in between, which means they have a lot of water.
In fact, I was reading for the first time about the Goldilocks notion, you know, not too cold, not too hot. I mean, in terms of habitability.
In terms of the habitable zone, this is indeed the case. You want a moderate temperature compared to the extremes of the universe we live in. And those moderate temperatures occur in a narrow range of distances from the mother star.
Let's bring in another caller. And Shoman, good morning. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello, this is Shamari. So, yeah, I want to thank the speaker for his work.
Sorry, Shamari.
I love reading about these exoplanets in the newspaper. It really excites me, so it's great. And I wanted to ask him how he thinks the discovery of life on another planet will affect sort of humanity's perspective. Will it have a great change on us as the first mission to the moon did? And might it maybe change the way we view what would happen to the average person, how they view the world?
Shamari, thank you for that question, because this one of the motivations behind what I'm trying to do is the realization that we are talking here about a shift in the human frame of reference. We often refer to that shift and connect it to what was done 500 years ago with Copernicus, where humanity for a long time had a completely different view of the world, where the frame of reference was fixed and absolute, and the Earth was that anchor, which made sense from a common sense point of view. That shift at the time was very unsettling. And in addition, it was revolutionary. That's why we call it the Copernican Revolution, because it brought about the opportunity for innovation and essentially created modern science and the Industrial Revolution. What is happening now is we are closing that chapter. Essentially, what the Kepler mission's goal is to historically enact that shift of the frame of reference, where the Earth now is just one of a multitude of Earths. And the next step, which is very important and which is why I wrote this book, is what about life? What is our human reference, frame of reference, when it comes to understanding life and not simply our spatial relationship to the sun and to the rest of the universe? And this is where the next big shift is going to occur, because once we understand the nature of life in the deepest sense in which we don't know it today, we will see ourselves in different light. And I think that could be unsettling, but certainly it will be as revolutionary as what happened 500 years ago.
Dimitar Saslov, again, our guest, director of Harvard Origins of Life Initiative and author of The Life of Super-Earths. A comment on our web from Melissa. Total science newbie question. How will different sized planets affect gravity and might dictate what types of life forms live on those different gravities?
That's a good question, Alicia. I often have to answer it because the name that got stuck to those bigger size planets, super-Earths, somehow supersizes them to the point where people are concerned about the very strong gravity on their surfaces. Well, there are two parts of the answer to this. Number one, the acceleration of gravity on the surface of a super-Earth planet, if it was rocky, would not be that significantly higher than what we have here on Earth. If we were to take a stroll down the beach of one of them, we'll probably feel quite a bit uncomfortable, but it's not going to kill us. On the other hand, I really want us to have a broader view of what life and life forms richness could entail. And hence, that small amount of additional gravity is probably not going to make a difference when it comes to the emergence of life, particularly because when it comes to chemistry, gravity is less important. As we know at least that much about biochemistry, that gravity is not the important factor.
Patrick writes, I am fascinated by the work you do. Can you talk a little bit about your own origins and how you got interested in your field and any advice for young people interested in science?
Well, Patrick, I hail from a small country, Bulgaria, from a small city on the coast of the Black Sea. And I grew up in a family that encouraged me to be curious and explore. I like to explore the rocks and the sea next door. For a while, I was fascinated by marine biology, and I might have ended up being a marine biologist. But the small telescope changed all that. I was lucky enough to see a comet that was passing by our planet Earth at the time, and was so excited about it that built this slightly bigger version of my own telescope. And as they say, the rest is history. My hobby became my profession.
And you're listening to Forum. We're talking with Dimitar Sazalov, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we have a Berkeley caller. Peter, good morning.
Hi, Michael, and hi, guest. I'm a layman, but I wanted to take a strike at defining life and see what you thought about that. Any system with the capacity to generate, organize, maintain, promote, and reproduce itself.
Peter, that's a very good try. Unfortunately, we don't have a definition because people don't agree even on something as obvious as this. And part of this is the caution that
I can't even agree when it comes to abortion.
That's true. But scientists are conservative and cautionary people. And the caution is we only have one example. We know life as it is here on planet Earth. And it may be foolish to assume that all its functions and properties really are generalizable to any other biochemistry. I would be curious to continue this conversation after you read chapter 8 in my book, because I discuss this issue there. But what you generally said is very close to what my working definition for life is, which sometimes is called the NASA definition or the one pioneered by Jerry Joyce from Scripps, which is exactly a self-sustaining chemical system capable of Darwinian evolution. And a lot of what you said was, in fact, that capability of Darwinian evolution.
And we thank you for your call, Peter. Here's Jason, who writes, could you ask your guest for clarification of his mention of the shadow biosphere? I haven't heard of this.
The concept of a shadow biosphere, which goes to many people, and Paul Davis of Arizona State is one of the people who's written about it, is that there were multiple origins in terms of biochemistry on our own planet. In fact, Charles Darwin himself discussed this in a letter as well. If life and its biochemistry were easy to emerge, naturally you would expect that they would emerge on this planet, at least in the beginning, when there was more space and the planet was not so toxic in terms of the free oxygen that is out there, multiple times. And it is quite logical to expect that maybe some of those forms of life survived, hidden somewhere, as some of the extremophilic microbes are hiding in very small nooks around. And maybe we haven't found them because we don't know how to look for them.
We'll look for another call. And that's you, Gary. Hi.
Welcome. Hi. Question. Given that plutonium is a man-made toxin that doesn't exist anywhere in nature by itself, is any thought given to the idea that maybe powering our deep space probes with plutonium like we do now is possibly not the best way to make a good impression impression on any life forms that those probes might encounter?
That's a good question. How do we make a good impression to our neighbors in the galaxy? Plutonium is a man-made element, but it is not unknown to the rest of the galaxy. When stars, which are more massive than the Sun, end their lives as supernovae, they produce a large array of radioactive isotopes and radioactive elements, including plutonium. They don't survive for very long. They are unstable elements. But the galaxy knows about all those elements which we learned to make here on our own planet.
Well, Gary may be concerned about the galaxy, but there was a lot of concern about plutonium. I mean, when the Saturn project went off, for example, coming down here to Earth, I recall. And David from Emerald Hills writes, isn't the growth of tubular plants at heated areas of the ocean bottom proof that other life systems exist?
The answer is no. When I refer to other life systems, I really mean a different chemistry, a different biochemistry. These are just some of our own tree of life, just very resilient forms that learned how to live down there.
Dimitar Sasilov, so good to have you with us this hour. Appreciate your being with us. And again, he's going to be at the Commonwealth Club this evening in San Francisco at 6 o'clock. Astronomy professor at Harvard, director of the Harvard Origins of Life Initiative, and author of The Life of Super Earths, How the Hunt for Alien Worlds and Artificial Cells Will Revolutionize Life on Our Planet. And the planned mission, by the way, the Kepler mission we've been talking about, is going to last at least 3.5 years. So lots of excitement on that score that will continue. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.